This is the AI Health Podcast, where we explore the ways in which AI will transform healthcare, biotech, and medicine through conversations with entrepreneurs, investors, and scientists.
Hey, I'm your co-host, Pranav Rajpurkar.
And I'm Adrielle Saporta.
And you're listening to the AI Health Podcast.
So one of the drivers of machine learning in every application is data. And we've spent time in previous episodes talking about the size of data sets that are driving machine learning advancements.
Yeah, we're in the big data era.
We are. And so I thought that we'd start by sharing with our listeners what big data means and how ready medicine is to handle big data.
All right, let's do it. At a high level, big data is a field that analyzes or deals with data sets that are large or complex. Originally, big data was associated with three key concepts: volume, variety, and velocity. Now, by volume, big data size is a constantly moving target ranging from a few dozen terabytes to many zettabytes of data.
And how many zeros is that?
So a terabyte is 1 trillion bytes, as in 1 with 12 zeros after it. 1 zettabyte is equal to 1 sextillion bytes, which is 1 with 21 zeros after it.
Oh my God. Well, there's your fun fact for the weekend, folks. Okay, so that's volume. What about variety and velocity?
So by variety, we mean the type and the nature of the data. Originally, databases were very good only at handling data that was structured in tables. But the demands of modern big data is to be able to handle text, images, audio, video. And then there's velocity, which is the speed at which data is generated and processed, where big data is produced continually and often available in real time.
And so we're contrasting big data to small data, where the data is small enough for human comprehension. So in a way, big data is about machines and small data is about people.
Yeah, small data is what I would say we used to think of as data. And for medicine, small data is still the way a large majority of decisions are made. Our guest today, Dr. Krumholz, has said every day there are millions of patients that are being treated, and the lessons from their experiences are lost because there is no systematic effort to learn from them. He says, if I'm sitting down with a patient, I should be able to take advantage of everything we've learned up until yesterday to treat them.
That's a great point. When we think about medical studies, they're still largely anchored in producing new knowledge through asking a narrow question. So for example, clinical trials often exclude complicated patients. So patients who may have had several medical ailments and complex treatment regimens. And complicated patients are the kinds of patients that are seen in medical offices. Studies, though, are most commonly focused on a single question and are not trying to simultaneously explore how various factors may interact to influence the result for a particular patient.
And that has made sense for medical research for centuries until the recent decade. The opportunity now is that with data generated every day for a variety of practical purposes, this could serve as an invaluable source of knowledge to fuel a learning healthcare system.
So what would be an example of a data-driven approach here?
Yeah, so as an example for something that's already been done, researchers can use unsupervised learning methods to reveal clusters of patient groups that might suggest new ways of grouping different subtypes of a disease. So based on how similar patients are according to a broad range of characteristics, including their outcomes.
For instance, based on biological, clinical, behavioral, and outcomes data, we're finding that there are many more types of diabetes or sepsis than previously appreciated.
Exactly. And this subtyping could be shown to have value in selecting what's the right treatment pathway for a patient or predicting how long a patient is likely to survive.
And one consideration here for this approach to work is that scientists and clinicians may want to know the underlying mechanisms of disease and response to therapy. So for example, if an algorithm said that on a particular patient's cancer, looking at their tissue, they were likely to respond to a particular therapy, then why would that drug work on that patient?
I think that's a great consideration. I think this knowledge can be useful even in advance of understanding what the underlying mechanism is of disease and response to therapy. So in medicine, there is precedent for discovering effective therapies, for example, aspirin, before knowing why it produced a benefit. In fact, as our guest has described, this is a common path for discovery.
And speaking of our guest today has been a champion of data to make decisions based on evidence. Since 1995, he's directed the Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation, otherwise known as CORE, at Yale, whose research has helped improve patient care by gathering, measuring, and analyzing all kinds of data, from billing records to medical records. Dr. Krumholtz is also a champion of open science and is the co-founder of MedArchive, a nonprofit preprint server for the medical and health sciences.
And just as a quick definition of preprints, preprints are preliminary versions of research articles that researchers share with each other before they're published in a journal in order to disseminate methods and finding between the community faster and to get feedback. And that's really accelerating the way that medical research is being shared.
So without further ado, let's chat with our wonderful guest, Dr. Harlan Krumholtz.
Dr. Krumholtz, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, so happy to be here.
I'll start by asking you about the research team you direct at the Yale Center for Outcomes Research and Evaluation, also called CORE, which you've been directing since 1995. And before we dive into everything that CORE has pioneered, I just want to start by asking you if you could define for our listeners what outcome research is all about.
Yeah, outcomes research is sort of this omnibus term that captures the notion that we are interested in the end result of what we do. And it was introduced maybe in the 1990s by Carolyn Clancy and John Eisenberg, who were leading what became the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality and the predecessor government agency. And what they were trying to capture was the idea that we are doing research for a reason. We're actually trying to have tangible impact on people's lives. We're trying to figure out how we can make society better, individuals healthier, the healthcare system functioning better, and that we ought to be judging ourselves against the results that we achieve. Other people have talked about results-based accountability. And, you know, it's sort of related. And when I was starting out in my career, I was yearning to make a difference. I really wanted to see scholarship as a stepping stone to impact. And so I'm very interested in rigor in the studies, in the quality of the evidence. I'm interested in asking questions that would make a change, but I'm also interested in then seeing the translation of that into something meaningful. And so what I found was that when I was getting advice about my career, people kept telling me, focus, take a more narrow approach to whatever it is you want to do. And in medicine, often they're rewarding you for the narrowness of your focus. So if I can focus on the sodium channel or the calcium channel, like exclusively, I can be the person who writes a chapter on that. When they need someone to give a lecture on that, when somebody thinks, who the heck is the expert in the world on this narrow piece of the universe, then they think of you. That's what kind of advice they're telling you. You know, be that person so that reflexively people will identify you. And my brain doesn't really work like that. I mean, my brain is sort of more horizontally integrated than is vertically integrated. I mean, I want to be strong in verticals that I'm working in, but I want to be able to try to link across and then ultimately see the translation of my work into action. And so at some point when people kept saying, well, what is it that you're doing? And again, remember, I'm a cardiologist. So people also wanted me to say, well, are you a cath person? Are you an echo person? Are you a heart failure person? Everyone gets defined by their condition or their procedure. And I kept saying that, no, that's not what I am. One day I sort of stumbled on this notion to say, you know what I am? I'm an outcomes researcher. My work is thematic. If you look at my work, it has common themes that's looking around effectiveness and efficiency and equity and patient-centeredness and timeliness and safety. And I'm looking to see whether or not we can elevate the way we're delivering care, the kind of care we're delivering, if I can put patients in a stronger position to make better decisions for themselves, if we can generate the kind of evidence that will really make a difference at the bedside and in populations. And then people start nodding their head and saying, oh, yeah, I get that, even if they didn't know what outcomes research was. So in a way, that term had gone into some disuse by the time that I sort of grabbed it again. And then in the American Heart Association, we started creating a council for outcomes research. We created a meeting for outcomes research. We created a journal for outcomes research. And it became an umbrella where people who were disaffected from a system that kept telling them focus narrowly on one little thing, but actually had broader vision of what they wanted to do, could come together under that umbrella. And then if you could see my career in the beginning, I'm more of a stats and epi person. That's what my formal training was in research. In the middle of my career, I'm mixed methods. I start doing qualitative research because I'm realizing that a lot of these questions, it's too reductionist in just using the stats and epi. I need to understand what's actually working on the ground. What are people saying? What are they experiencing? And now in this, I consider my third phase of my career, I sort of pivot towards the digital transformation and recognize that what I need to do now, and this was now starting maybe almost 10 years ago, is I now need to get a whole new set of skills that puts me in a position so that we can generate the kind of knowledge, it can be precise and actionable, and that we can learn faster and get smarter with every interaction within healthcare. And I can leverage my early experience in stats and epi. I can pull forth my experience in communities, community-based participatory research and the qualitative research. And now I can see its application. And now how do we turbocharge that with the kind of tools and capabilities that are afforded to us as a result of the digital transformation and the advances in advanced analytics and different ways of doing things that I'm seeing in industries around us, but aren't really being brought to bear within healthcare.
And outcomes research has come such a long way in the past few decades. CORE, the center that you direct, has architected the national public reporting of hospital performance and pioneering new approaches to measurement that are widely accepted and reported by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So I'd love to understand the story here. How did that happen?
I get really great training and mentorship. I'm at Harvard, but within there, it's very hierarchical. People I admire the most are people who sort of broke new ground, went off on their own. You know, so I go down to Yale where I was an undergrad, and I see that I'm going to get a lot of free time. And one day I'm started thinking, you know, I really need a center of gravity. I need to be able to like bring people together under the things that I want to do. I'm just beginning to think about this idea of outcomes research because we do name this thing Center for Outcomes Research. So I go to the university and say, I've got this idea, this center, and it's all predicated on this hybrid model. We're really trying to have impact. The scholarship is in partnership with the impact. And I think that we can find a place where we can derive insights from data. We can see it translated into action. We can work with strategic partners. And the university says, you got to be kidding. You're 2 years on faculty. You know, a center requires an approval by the Yale Corporation. You know, that's just not going to work. So then again, being kind of persistent, I go to the hospital and I say, you know, I want to start this center. And even before I get out the pitch, they say, yeah. So I'm going, so what do I have to do? They say, I don't know, call yourself a center. So like, that's basically the story. So then I started the center and then I proposed to them, we could start doing a variety of things, and it was helping in the hospital. We haven't gotten any, actually, we never got any investment from the hospital or the university, and we were just always bootstrapped this up because it just was able to start calling it something. And like this thing of what we've done with the government around measurement wasn't really about like, hey, let's do measures. It was about saying that we've got to make visible what's invisible. The healthcare system is not going to tack to address something that they can't see. And so if all they see are the money flows, and they don't recognize the quality that's being provided, we're not going to make any progress towards elevating the overall quality or value within the healthcare. It's everyone's going to just be responding to the money side, which is still a dominant incentive, but you've got to start showing people what the reality is of the quality of care that's being delivered. It was kind of more about social engineering. It was like, how are we going to get there? Who would we need to work with? And from early on, I mean, there are long stories of how I get involved with the government, but it's like along the similar themes, like there's some meeting somewhere. And in the beginning, like I'm in my office, mostly sharpening pencils, trying to think of ideas, you know, it's like somebody invites me to a meeting. And then at the meeting, like people don't really see the possibility, but I see like, oh my God, this could actually change everything. And like, so we get involved and then it just starts growing organically over time. And we're in a fortunate position where after many years of working with the government, like they don't tell us what to do. We don't tell them what to do. We kind of work together to solve problems. And, you know, it's developed into a really great partnership. On a usual academic thing, you're throwing rocks over the wall. Like you're saying, hey, this ought to be better. You publish an article. I just wish someone paid attention to this. Or why can't someone do something about it? And we started recognizing that if we could work synergistically, maintaining our independence, but still being able to help the regs and to be able to influence the implementation of legislation and try to steer, in this case, what might be measured. I mean, the measurement, for example, on the mortality side was CMS came to us and said, well, we'd like to start putting together the variation in cost by hospital. And we said, oh, we've done mortality. And they asked us for the next one. to do cost. And we said, well, why don't we look at readmissions? Because that's expensive. No one's really measuring it. And for patients, it's burdensome.
But CMS came to you and asked you. Like, they acknowledged that they needed some more information here.
Well, we had been working with them, and we kind of were able to steer them towards readmission. But the issue is trying to be entrepreneurial about, like, what's the adjacent possible? There's this theory about, like, you want to make big change, but, like, what's the next thing you can do that gets you on the path towards the transformative change you want to make? Sometimes you're lucky enough to get in, I guess, into a wormhole, and you can just, like, make transformative change, like, immediately, and you end up somewhere different in short periods of time. But in usual world, you got to sort of figure out, like, well, what's the next thing that would be acceptable that keeps us on the road toward where we want to be eventually? And that's what our work with the government's been. It's been amazing, and they've really been great. We've maintained our independence, never felt, you know, in any way censored, or, you know, that we couldn't speak our mind.
I want to ask about one particular application which you mentioned, which was readmissions. And in the scope of readmissions, one of the things that we've seen in terms of development of machine learning models is that we're able to demonstrate that with machine learning, we're able to predict which patients are going to get readmitted and possibly have interventions delivered to them. But one of the challenges with this has been, although there have been a ton and ton of papers on the development of these technologies, there has been a very limited amount of work actually bringing this out to practice. So I want to start by asking you about this delta. What would it take for us to go into a world in which these readmissions models are being routinely used to deliver interventions in patient care?
So that's a really great question. Let me jump off on a couple points about it. One is that I believe that what the healthcare system broadly needs is not the information, but the systems that sort of are end to end. So if you tell me about risk of a patient, the problem is within the healthcare system, they don't know what to do with that. What I really need is for that to inform some larger system that is iteratively testing the response to that so that I can know whether or not what I'm doing as a whole, using that information and the action that it brings about, is bringing the desired outcome. So, for example, if Amazon has an amazing algorithm that says something about my preferences, that's of no value unless that then causes the website to change and the way in which it's presenting information. And by the way, that information about my preferences from the algorithm can have a wide range of actions that it could potentially precipitate, right? I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean that will get me to buy something. It depends how it's presented to me and what colors it's in and where it sits on the screen. And ultimately, whether it's accompanied by one-click purchase, and a lot of features are still required to take that information into some action and presentation that leads to what they care in the end, which is, did it get me to purchase something that I might not have purchased otherwise, because it kind of stimulated something. In medicine, I see that people want to declare victory when they've got some algorithm. They're going, like, wouldn't this be great to know what the risk is? Or like Mayo just spun off a company that just says that we can tell what your risk of atrial fibrillation is from your electrocardiogram. And my response to it was, I think that's great, but it's necessary but not sufficient to actually produce the outcomes that I care about. Again, as an outcomes researcher, I'm saying at the end of the day, what's that feeding into it? And I had this experience. We ran this big trial for NIH, $10 million trial that I was so convinced was going to work, that was around, at that time, more primitive technologies, but it was essentially listening daily information from the patients who had heart failure at home. And we were convinced that by being able to pick up early slight changes in their symptom complex, slight maybe increases in depressions, we were also checking weights, you know, that we would be able to respond and preempt problems. And I'm still convinced that seems like a really good idea. But then, by the way, we had all these training sessions with the sites that we were on. Here, if you hear this information, you ought to do this. If you get this information, you ought to do that. But it didn't go to a central group. It went to the offices. But then what happened was, they still reacted very differently to each patient. One group, like 2 pounds up, they ignored. Somebody else changed the medication. Somebody else did another thing. I mean, the information came in, but what happened as a result was quite varied. And in the end, the trial didn't produce any benefit from the intervention. And to me, it started getting me thinking a lot about how it's really about the system. So the information's one component of a system. And then in order to get the desired, it's almost like you have to build the logic diagram. And at the end of the logic diagram is, what I really want is people to be healthier. What has to happen for that to happen? And it's not just that I've got an algorithm that tells me risk. In this case, if I want to reduce readmissions, that's a, I think, a very helpful component of a system. But then you've got to have like, so what do I do as a result? And I need to be constantly refining it and improving it. But the principal issue is for the hospitals, they make more money still by the readmissions in a fee-for-service system than they do by the penalties caused by the government. There's another piece of the readmission story, which is around this sleep disruption, malnutrition, stress, all the things happening in the hospital kind of put people in a weaker position, even independent of the reason they were being admitted. I call this post-hospital syndrome. It's kind of like all this stuff happens and then they're weaker. So the hospitals, they aren't addressing either end, both what goes on in the hospital, how can I make sure people are stronger when they leave? And then how can I make sure that there's something to catch them? Because I want to be able to put more resources toward the people at higher risk. The last thing is, reason readmission is so such a cool issue is socioeconomic status doesn't predict readmission very well, but Black race does. And there's probably a piece of structural racism in this, which is like, what kind of access do people have? Are they living in food deserts? And what kind of barriers are they up against when they go out? It's very interesting. It's not so much income, but it's more race. It could, in the positive side, lead me to try to understand what are the barriers these people are facing. On the other side, some people are advocating for including these kind of factors in the risk adjustment. So it's just basically saying, like, it's a hospital saying, it's not fair. I have a lot of Black patients. Those patients have higher readmission. Like, I should be getting credit for sicker patients, higher risk patients, because I have them. Instead of saying that, no, that's a problem. We shouldn't just default and surrender to say, like, yeah, you're right, because you're Black in our society, you're going to be more likely to be readmitted. We actually need to disentangle that and understand it. So it could mean, it could make a better risk adjustment or algorithm for prediction, but it may not be something actually you want in there, even though it would predict better.
Absolutely. It's clear that this is a complex system. Do you feel like there's any hope for, let's say, a minimum viable product, an MVP here? And just to give an example, so let's say an algorithm says, these set of patients are most likely to be readmitted in the next month. Let's say there was a small system associated with that where all they did in terms of interventions was call up the patients or schedule an outpatient appointment. Do you feel like there's a pathway here in which we are starting with these small MVPs and then working our way onto complex systems?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't interpret my comments as being anything but really enthusiastic about the power of the information. I'll reflect on some of the work that we're doing. So we're doing projects, I'm calling them falling through the cracks projects. Like, you know, who's falling through the cracks? Whose risk is being underappreciated? How are we capturing an understanding of them? And the work that we're doing is to try to not just understand the risk, but to try to understand there can be people with similar risk, but are actually very separate clusters with regard to what's underlying the risk and how you might intervene. And so how do we begin to say, is this about education? Is it about inability to get medications? Is it about inability to get healthy food? Is it about inability to get an appointment? Is it about getting an appointment with people who are indifferent to the particular barriers you're facing? I mean, as physicians, we're taught a biomedical model, but there are a lot of people for whom, like, the social determinants will be, as I was suggesting before, might be dominant, or structural racism or other issues. And so how can we make sure, no, this person needs a social worker. No, this person needs a health educator. No, this person actually needs a physician. This person could be handled by a nurse practitioner. And then, so how do you get there? That's going to be a lot of A-B testing. It's like, how do we begin to understand and recognize that it's not one size fits all? That's where we want to go. We want to really understand the heterogeneity, both in outcomes, but also in mechanism. What are the targets? In the same way that we've got a lot of companies propping up about targets for therapeutics and diagnostics, you know, I think for us, these targets may be, sometimes they're medical, sometimes they're social, sometimes they're behavioral. You know, there's a wide range of areas that I think that we need to start getting more sophisticated about how we are thinking about this. But I'm very high on this. I just think we've been maybe too simplistic in our thinking. Like, if I just can know what your risk is, I'm clustering you together in a risk band. But actually, that may be obscuring a substantial amount of heterogeneity, and that you don't respond to a particular intervention doesn't mean that there wouldn't be people who would respond to a different intervention. And so how do I begin to understand those subclusters within the risk band? So now I'm high risk. Great. I can afford to spend more money on this group because they're going to incur more costs if I'm in a value-based construct. But I still need to be able to get more insight in order to be able to understand how do I best customize and personalize the approach.
I love what you said about algorithms being a necessary but not sufficient way of sort of doing things going forward, and that it's really about systems. And I feel like Pranav and I learn and talk to so many people about all these great new technologies that are coming out that could do X, Y, and Z. And our question is always, okay, well, why aren't we using it? What's sort of stopping us from changing the way that we do things? And I'm curious if you would say that was maybe the number one reason that we're not seeing more instances of AI in healthcare, or that if that's sort of the biggest obstacle facing the industry, or if there are other things that you would point to that we need to be wary of.
I mean, I think incentives are part of it. I think understanding how these feed into systems. I mean, imagine like Apple, like the algorithms themselves are meaningless, but the design features on the watch, like it's what feeds in and how it's displayed and how it fits into people's use. And so, you know, it's all in the service of thinking about end to end, and then how do the users use it? We have another issue that I think is worth bringing up to the audience, which is that, you know, largely the research enterprise within medicine remains anchored in the 1980s. So there are people at the cutting edge of the future, people like you all, who are thinking about how this goes. But if you go to the medical meetings, largely, you're seeing them using methodologies that, you know, logistic regression, things are tried and true. And the reason is because they have a case report form mentality. So what we did was, how we managed a complex system was, we put a human being in front of a large amount of data, and we filled out discrete fields. And we start talking about missing data. If you didn't have this, it was a missing data. And we would take complex, rich data, and we would turn it into dichotomous variables. And, you know, we're really proud of ourselves, you know. And then it would be something like, maybe we'd had 100 measures of cholesterol, and we would say dyslipidemia, yes or no. And if you had zero in that field, that's probably a homogeneous field. But if you put everyone who had a one, and you ask a doctor to take a look at all those charts, like they would be scratching their head going, these are very different people. You know, these are not the same people. And so you're misclassifying or obscuring the heterogeneity within that. You've thrown away so much data by defaulting into this sort of simplistic way of doing it. And as a result, you know, that's the way most doctors think. That's the studies they're used to. The clinical trials work like that. They just collect these sort of standard pieces of information. And so you don't have the research enterprise within medicine thinking this. And when I'm giving the talk broadly, I'm going like, well, so imagine Amazon did this. In that world, there's sometimes the data is sparse and sometimes it's dense and it's coming in different times. But I mean, you're creating algorithms in the feature engineering to say, how do I use everything I know about you to be able to predict? And I might borrow power from the group or people who are like you. I mean, there's a whole range of strategies that I might employ, but I'm sure as hell not going to throw away data. I mean, that would be crazy, but that's what we do in medicine. So like their mindset and culturally, they're not really thinking about like, now, how do we get across the finish line with leveraging this?
Why hasn't the mindset evolved at all, do you think?
Because they all grew up in this culture where they're used to either protocolized data collection, or they're used to data that may be real world, but now has been put in the format of a protocolized data collection because a human being has sat in front of it and filled out a form. And so, I mean, when I talk about like the use of the data, and people going like, but there's a lot of missing data. Like, not everybody had 100 creatinines measured or every, you know, it's like, yeah, but why would I throw it away? Like, you know, I can vectorize, I can show in space, like who these people are. Like, there's lots of strategies here to be able to think about this that everyone else is using. I mean, imagine Tesla going like millions of data points on every drive, and then we're just going to pick out 25 into a case report form. I mean, literally, that's what we do in medicine. I mean, we produce this sort of reductionist view of it, and then now we try to do something with that. And then, you know, we just came out with a paper that sort of showed that if you use registry data, it almost doesn't matter if you use logistic regression or machine learning. It's the amount of additional predictive power you get out of it is not very big. What I hoped that people would understand about this is like, no, we are not making a verdict on machine learning. That verdict's been leveled. It's useful. This is a verdict on like, if you feed it really simplistic data, it can't do anything with it. Because like I said, you've misclassified so many people because you're saying they're the same and they're different. It can only go so far. And, you know, logistic regression gets you the same. What I hear other people say, yeah, well, this is just a fad. Who cares about this machine learning thing? I'm going like, do you like your phone? Do you realize what it's doing for you in your everyday life?
And do you hear that? Like, is that really the level of pushback that you're hearing?
I've heard people say like, well, I can't see where it's providing any benefit. And you're going like, because it depends on the inputs to a large extent. And it also depends on what questions you're asking. Hmm. But I mean, literally, I have heard people say that. I'm going like, so you're going to say that you really think we'd be the same as a society without it. I mean, is that right? Is that your thesis? Because like, I just don't think that's true. Whether, by the way, we may be better or worse, I'm not arguing with it, but we're different
right.
as a result of it.
It's clear there's a mindset and culture component here that's providing this resistance. One of CORE's international initiatives included a decade-long collaboration with the Chinese National Center for Cardiovascular Diseases that's serving as a foundation for healthcare reform and quality improvement efforts across China. And I just wanted to hear your take on the differences and the similarities in the way healthcare is approached in the two countries. And specifically on your previous point, do you see a difference in the mindset here?
Well, I mean, of course, China's a very different place. And even today, it's a different place than when I started. I started working there maybe in 2008. But let me say, I was very fortunate to work with a group that was a brilliant group who was driven by a sense of social mission that wanted to be able to take advantage of some of the work that we had been doing, recognizing that we were exposing performance within the healthcare system and variation in quality, and be able to sort of follow a bit of the lead that we had taken in trying to get improvements in the quality of care. And they were quite ambitious in trying to think about how they could make great strides across the country. They think big. So we were able to launch a study of 5 million people across the country in the community health centers with community health workers. And, you know, the physicians there in those community health centers, like high school graduates, they were sort of the legacy of the Barefoot Doctors and, you know, very dedicated people. We went around the country working with them. We also were, the group I worked with had been working with Oxford and had been running a lot of the clinical trials. And so they were very savvy in running trials, but they were mostly the centers, like they weren't generating them themselves. And I was prevailing on them to start thinking about the kind of tests and experiments and observational studies that they could do at scale in China that would improve the performance of a system that was moving quite quickly, but had palaces that were, you know, very much the equal of the very best centers in here, the hospitals that were just remarkable, but also there were still large numbers of people in poverty in areas of the country that were not being reached, and things, simple things like hypertension were still not being addressed to a great extent. And the non-communicable diseases were rising rapidly within a context of a country that had undergone the epidemiologic transition. So I found it was different in the sense that if the Chinese government decided to do something, they could get it done. But I also found it that despite the regulations from Beijing, that there was still, just like there is everywhere, lots of variation in the quality, lots of ways that people were doing things locally. And there was no hammer here, like you must do this. It was a question, could we work with the communities of community health workers to try to understand what were their challenges? How could this work? And then how could feedback of data, how could the routine collection of data, how could insights from data help drive that? We were also working with hospitals in the same way. You can imagine that over there, they were nervous about exposing that. We were wondering whether the government would even allow, you know, us to talk about variations in practice. And we were able to broker all of that. And, you know, from my point of view, it's like when you can work together like this, maybe you're showing that when we're working on healthcare, you know, we're all on the same side, and that, you know, when we're fighting disease, we're all on the same side. It doesn't always work out that way, but that was what the mission was.
You mentioned about China that they think big, and I wonder to what extent you feel like they're able to think big because maybe there are fewer concerns around data sharing and privacy internally. I know you mentioned that you were worried that they may be concerned about sort of exposing data to outside people, but sometimes I wonder to what extent privacy around data is sort of holding us back in the US.
Yeah, you know, I mean, just my experience in China was very much that, of course, we know that the government's, you know, involved in a lot of activities that is understanding their population and the ways in which, you know, between surveillance and the cameras and the cards, the identity cards and the social scores and things like that. But I will tell you, when it came to medical data, at least in the group that I was working in, there was a lot of respect that people's data was private and theirs. And so they were very strict about that. And so we were very careful. I didn't see that as the issue, maybe in the population that people had some sort of expectation, but really actually we took it very seriously. And I didn't really see that as being a difference. What they can do on a national level is basically decide, like, they can have a master protocol. And when the government tries to get hospitals to engage in research projects, they're more likely to be able to get them to engage. I mean, there's a sense, I think, of that. And it's twofold. It's not just, I mean, at least my experience of it was not like fear of the government, but more of a sense of communal duty that this is something that they want to do. If anything, in this country, it's more like we're mavericks and individuals, and everyone sort of feels like they should go it on their own. And so it's hard to get consortia of hospitals to really want to work together, or consortia of doctors or teams. I mean, everyone else kind of wants to go, I'm trying to promote this notion of team science and saying we need to get away from the notion of superstars, and we need to get more towards the idea that together what we accomplish as a team can be quite profound if we're willing not to worry about credit. And, you know, that's not an easy thing. We do have to be attentive to what each person needs in their careers, in their lives, but we also need to be thoughtful about within our academic institutions, how do we credit teams? Because if we continue to say that, you know, I'm just only going to have superstars, then at least within academia, we'll never achieve what we can, because this is a world of team science now. You just simply can't do it on your own. And so we've got to be able to find ways to reward that. I'll just quickly say this, that, you know, when people work on the Human Genome Project, it was like they gave credit because they were part of something that enabled a lot of other people to do a lot more. And by the way, in the machine learning and in the AI and in the CS and data science communities, I mean, I see an amazing amount of generosity posting code on GitHub, you know, much more than within medicine. And still people can get credit and be acknowledged for what their contributions are, but that there's a lot of sharing. In medicine right now, we're still in a position where a lot of data gets sequestered. People don't necessarily share code. The accountability and reproducibility of the methods is sometimes questioned because we're not seeing that sort of free flow. And I think that we need to get to that place too.
I would be remiss not to mention MedArchive as pushing the frontier of collaboration and of sharing research as quickly as it's been happening, especially during COVID. I'd love for you to chat a little bit about that and how MedArchive is shaping the way the culture is shifting in medicine and in medical research.
Yeah, so MedArchive it was a sense I had that we needed a way to be able to share our research in motion. And while it's wending its way through peer review, which sometimes in our world can take years, if we have any sense that there's an urgency in medicine to have impact, we need to have the means by which we can reach collaborators and be able to communicate among ourselves and get feedback and encourage each other or even, you know, critique and criticize different approaches so we can get better. And so the idea of MedArchive was, can we create that within the clinical science area and do it in a way that has some guardrails on it, because we recognize we have a little bigger responsibility that somebody could take something on a preprint server and act on it and not recognize it hasn't been peer reviewed. So we have to have a lot of disclaimers, and we do some screening. If we think, for example, say there was some catastrophic complication from something that we think is, you know, in the public's interest, it's not that we're judging whether that's true or not. We're just saying that may be better through peer review, that, you know, we're trying to be a little careful about, but I'm just so proud of it. The community came together in COVID. Everyone around the world was able to use it as a means to disseminate information. It meant that it wasn't just on Twitter, wasn't just on a press release or whatever. It was actually, you could see the manuscript and then comment on it. And by the way, when I talk about this, I say, look, I'm interested in data science. If I depended on peer review publications and data science, I would be years behind. I mean, I can't do that. I have to look at the preprints. I'm working hard to spread the news because people are still risk averse with the medicine. They're not quite sure how they can use it. We've grown rapidly, but a lot of it from COVID. We have grown also in the other areas faster than BioArchive, but still we have a ways to go in terms of it's getting people to understand what it can do.
At one point, you gave an example of an AI-assisted future in medicine and what that will look like with a hypothetical example of a patient at risk of heart failure. And I was wondering if you could maybe share that illustration with our audience.
I mean, there's many potential applications. And let me just say, I think in pattern recognition, it should be a game changer. I mean, our brains don't work as well in pattern recognition as the algorithms, and at least as assist to us, it should help us avoid misdiagnosis when we're reading things like images or electrocardiograms, or we're listening to things like heart sounds. I can take this information beyond what my ears can hear, or on the images, beyond what my eyes can see, and I can give an output about the probability of what that means. That's 90%, that's the person had severe mitral regurgitation, one of the valves is leaking. Or based on that image, I can now translate that, not just telling me what it is, but how does that relate to probabilities in the future and potentially responses or a whole range of things, plus being able to integrate multiple images over time or multiple sounds over time to get the dynamic nature of how things are changing. So, I mean, I'm really high on that, but I'm also high on this notion of the real world data, which is uneven in quality and in its cadence and availability, you know, the sampling frequency in essence. Some people have missed, I don't like the word missing, but they don't have data in this period, they have data in this period. So it's putting a premium on us to sort of figure out, now, how do we take all that and get signal? What kind of signals do we need? How do we reform our entire taxonomy of disease by understanding people in different ways with inputs from biology and then from behaviors and from social determinants, and be able to say, I mean, how many types of diabetes are there? Likely hundreds of types of diabetes, not just, you know, one and two and then late onset and so forth. But, you know, how do we begin to do this in heart failure? It's sort of like, yeah, how do I begin to classify correctly, be able to take in new data as it becomes available? How do we get a collective intelligence so that we're getting smarter with each person coming through? And how do I make it so that I don't have to have gray hair at the end of a career where I've seen a lot to recognize that this is this and be able to take advantage of what everyone else is seeing? So we're all getting smart at the same time. And the early doctor gets the benefit of that collective wisdom, and that catapults them into the position of an expert clinician from the day that they're starting, rather than like, no, you've got to make a bunch of mistakes and see it a bunch of time and miss it until you finally get to the point where you're now mature in your outlook. And so, you know, I think that between the taxonomy, the continuous learning, the dynamic nature, getting smarter, the interaction. And again, I bring it back to like, you know, Google's algorithm changes every microsecond. It changes, imperceptible to you, but over time it's continuing to evolve, let alone the A-B testing they're doing, but also same with every mile, Tesla gets smarter. Every click, Amazon gets smarter. You know, there's a flywheel thing going on. That is not going on in medicine. I mean, we're the only place. We don't have the platform where we're getting smarter with every interaction. And all of that data, all those experiences get essentially wasted in terms of creating a collective wisdom. I'm hopeful that these kind of tools will emerge and that, yeah, when the next person comes in with heart failure, they're benefited by the person who preceded them. They're going to help the person behind them. And we're able to customize, personalize, and learn from the experiences as we go.
Dr. Krumholz, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. This was fabulous.
Yeah, that was great fun.
And that's all, folks. A big thank you to Dr. Harlan Krumholz for talking to us today. And thank you for listening. We're your hosts, Pranav and Adriel. And until next time, stay safe and stay healthy.
The AI Health Podcast is produced and edited by Oishi Banerjee. Music by Ethan Achey. If you like what you just heard, let a friend know. Subscribe to the show and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Spotify or connect with us on Twitter @AI Health Podcast.